This summer we have been focused on a sermon series centered on the question of building out God's reign on earth. The title of the series is taken from a Dutch sociologist, Utopia for Realists. We've been looking at what this reign of God looks like in the real world. So we continue that series today with this sermon, based on this passage from 1 Corinthians 13, Paul's famous commentary on the nature of love. I invite you now to listen for God's living word to you in these words and in what follows. We're going to actually start with the last verse of chapter 14. But strive for the greater gifts, Paul writes, and I will show you a still more excellent way. If I speak in the tongues of mortals and angels, but do not have love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give away all my possessions and if I hand over my body so that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. Love does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoings, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. But as for prophecies, they will come to an end, and for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will come to an end. For we know only in part, and we prophesy only in part. But when the complete comes, the partial will come to an end. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I will know fully, even as I have been fully known. And now faith, hope, and love abide, these three. But the greatest of these is love. The word of God for the people of God. On Wednesday of this week, several hundred students 300, several hundred students gathered, along with their parents, gathered right here in this chapel to be welcomed to Warren Wilson by President Lynn Morton and the other members of her cabinet, the deans and the vice presidents of the college. If you were here that day, and by show of hands, it appears that quite a few of you were, then you might think that I owe the title of this sermon to Dr. Morton. Among her other comments, Lynn observed that after 6 weeks on the job here, her personal motto for Warren Wilson College is, anybody? We're all in. Don't worry, they don't remember what I say either. It's okay. I believe she intended the motto to convey to this class of new arrivals that the college has your backs. That everyone from the president to the deans and the VPs and to the faculty to the staff, everyone who works at the college comprises a community that is dedicated not just to the students' education, but to their well-being, to their development as fully realized human beings. And that together, all of these people are prepared to make the kinds of investments that will enable the students to go out into the world when they leave this place and change it for the better. Now, as you can see, I myself was inspired by that motto, in part because it's also a pretty accurate description of what we're about here as a faith community. Whatever your age, whatever your station in life, whatever opportunities that might greet you, whatever challenges that might befall you, we, too, are all in. Whether faith comes as naturally to you as breathing, or whether you've never quite been sure there is a God, well, together, we've got your back. Whether it feels like your future is bright and stretching out in front of you like a golden dream, or whether it feels like you've just been hit by your own personal hurricane and your life is now in ruins, we've got your back. Whether your heart has been shattered by a breakup or your leg has been shattered in a car crash, we've got your back. When you walk through those doors, we will offer you always, we will offer you a warm welcome, perhaps a warm hug. When times are tough, we'll offer you a piece of chocolate pie and a Kleenex to comfort you. And when everything falls apart, we'll bring mops and buckets and brooms and tools to clean up the mess and to help put things back together again, because that is who we are. And that's how we roll here at the Warren Wilson Presbyterian Church. So it was tempting to reframe this entire sermon around Lynn's wonderful phrase, but the truth is, I was already planning to preach on a motto of my own. Or I should say, a motto of our own. Because we do have one here at Warren Wilson Presbyterian. It's painted on the banner hanging over the front doors that greeted you on your way in this morning. And it's stitched into that beautiful banner right there on that rock wall. Love above all. This motto comes to us on good authority. They will know you are my disciples, Jesus says. How? If you have love one for another. We take Jesus at his word on this point, which is why we believe that love is indeed above all. We prize it, love, above doctrine. We esteem it above belief in ancient creeds and even in modern creeds for that matter, however good and important and useful those resources may be. And for reasons I'll come back to in just a moment, we even believe that love is above faith itself. So for us, love above all is more than a motto. It's the foundation of our life together as a community. It lies at the heart of our practice as a congregation. And there's no better text in all of Scripture to showcase what this love looks like than 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. Now, this is only the introduction. Those few phrases there are only the introduction to Paul's famous commentary on the nature of love. And to be honest, the full picture he paints, the picture he gives us of what love looks like, is actually rather idealized. It's one that all of us normal, imperfect human beings fall short of on the regular. But it's worth getting this full litany of love tattooed on our hearts, because when it comes to Christian practice, if you get love right, if you get this right, you get everything right. Now that said, it's also worth remembering that love is not the only spiritual virtue named in this passage. It's just one of three such virtues, a kind of holy trinity that also includes faith and hope. Now granted, love is the greatest of these virtues. It stands above the other two, including faith. But it's not the only one. And I say this because right now, at this particular moment in American history, perhaps this particular moment in our lives as individuals, this moment in our lives as Americans, faith and hope are pretty important too. On Monday, many of us watched as a relatively small celestial object that has no light of its own gradually slid in front of the brightest star, the brightest object in the sky, our very own local star. By slow and steady degrees, the air cooled off as the enormous quantity of radiant life that ordinarily heats the earth slowly got blocked out, as if God were turning a celestial rheostat. The bright light of midday gradually faded into something that looked and felt more like the light of evening, except it was not the luminous golden light of evening that we're all accustomed to, that we love and enjoy. Instead, the light was greenish and eerie, and frankly, it felt and looked a little spooky. And then, for the millions of people who, either by accident or intention, found themselves in the so-called, I love this phrase, the so-called path of totality. The light finally shrank to a tiny orange crescent. And then, suddenly, just like that, the sun itself, looking through those glasses, the sun itself disappeared. Now granted, taking off the glasses, the view in the sky above was jaw-dropping and awe-inspiring, and I will never forget it. But down here, where we all live, it was dark and eerie at 2:34 in the afternoon. Bats were flying overhead. It was colder than it should have been at that time of day, at this time of year, at the tail end of summer. In that moment, the world not only felt changed, it felt wrong. I had great sympathy for what it must have been like for pre-scientific people to experience an event like this, how terrifying it must have been for them to live through something they couldn't understand or didn't expect, something they couldn't explain, something over which they had no power, something that made it feel like normal life had come unhinged and that it might end altogether. Which may be a little like how some of you are feeling right now. Some of you have recently said goodbye to your parents, and you've now been to your first few college classes. Perhaps most of you students are doubtless thrilled by this turn of events. You've taken to your new life and your new freedom like a rocket to a launch pad. Bang, you are off blasting toward your future, and there's no looking back. But maybe for a few of you, the college experience so far has felt more like something over which you have no control. Maybe the world around you feels a little unfamiliar, a little spooky. Maybe that's true of the world inside you, too. It's a little dark, a little unsettling. And if you're perfectly honest, maybe you have no idea how you're going to make it through the next 4 years. That was how I felt when I was in your shoes. If that's true for you, take heart. You are not alone. Many of us, perhaps most of us, maybe even all of us, aren't quite sure how we're going to get through these next 4 years either. It feels like the world at hand, the world we know and love, the world whose rhythms we trust and depend on. This world, it feels like this world has not only changed, it feels wrong. We watch as white nationalists march through the streets of America, chanting literal Nazi slogans, waving literal Nazi flags. And it feels like a kind of darkness has fallen. We watch as, yes, and it is the preacher's job to say this, the highest elected official in the United States repeatedly takes the wrong side of history, endorsing the white supremacists, pardoning an unrepentant, law-breaking, grotesquely racist judge. And it feels like the life we've always known has come unhinged. This is not the America we know. This is not the America we love and believe in. Every day, it feels a little darker out there than it should. Every day, relations between neighbors grow just a little bit cooler. And as the darkness deepens, our streets feel less safe than they should, more hostile and violent than they've been since Americans of all races and faiths took to the streets to fight for the right of African Americans to be recognized as full human beings some 50 years ago. At a time like this, aren't you glad that faith abides along with love? Because as we learned on Monday, when you're standing in the darkness and the sun itself has vanished, it takes faith to believe that the light will come again. Now, the good news is that as Christian folk, we know this story well. The even better news is that we also know how it ends. Our faith, after all, was born in a kind of eclipse. The sky literally went dark on that first Good Friday, and for the disciples, the darkness persisted for the next 3 days until finally the bright light of hope broke through again when Christ burst out of that dark tomb on the first Easter morning. From that moment on, the Christian faith has been rooted in the belief that in the world God has made, light always displaces darkness eventually. In the world God has made, love always wins in the end. And if the light has not yet broken through, and if love has not yet won, then it's not the end. There is still more work to do. Now, of course, I suspect that this probably strikes you as exactly what you'd expect a preacher to say on a Sunday like this, except I'm not just giving you my personal theology. We've seen the truth of this claim play out repeatedly on the world historical stage. We've heard it in famous stories we tell again and again about famous people in famous places, people like Martin Luther King Jr. and Desmond Tutu, in places like Selma and Soweto. So I'm going to highlight the truth of this claim today with a less familiar story about a less famous person in a less familiar place. James Stockdale, sadly no relation to Dennis that I know of. James Stockdale, or to be more precise, and I love this, James Bond Stockdale, started off his military career as a naval aviator. In 1964, he was stationed on the USS Oriski, which was in turn stationed off the coast of Vietnam. On what became his last mission, Stockdale's A-4 Skyhawk jet was shot down. He was promptly taken captive by the Viet Cong, and he spent the next 7.5 years in the notorious Ho Lao prison, better known as the Hanoi Hilton. Now, you can argue that, and I think you should, that have this argument, that James Bond Stockdale ought not to have been flying bombing raids over Vietnam in the first place. That's a legitimate argument, but it's also one for another time and place. What you can't argue about is what happened next. As the highest-ranking officer among the population of American prisoners, it was Commander Stockdale's job to lead his men in fighting the good fight, the fight to keep their faith alive, the fight to keep themselves alive. He did this by building the prisoner's resilience, and he did that in turn through the practice of what my wife calls ferocious optimism. Ferocious. Don't you love that? Ferocious optimism. To use the biblical term, hope. Stockdale observed early on that the men who did not last were the ones who embraced a kind of Pollyanna optimism, which is a fancy way of saying that the men who died in that prison lived in denial. So Stockdale did a difficult and counterintuitive thing. He encouraged his men to be honest about their plight and to embrace two opposing truths at the same time. One, that their life as prisoners was in fact brutally difficult, and help was not likely on the immediate horizon. And two, despite their deprivations, despite their hardship, two, with faith and patience, they could survive to the end until help finally did come. They had the resources to make it to the end. Stockdale's unusual reality-based survival strategy was so successful it became famous, and it bears his name to this day, the Stockdale Paradox. You can look it up. So yes, here's what I imagine the Stockdale Paradox might sound like today. Yes, the darkness of this moment is deep, but this is our moment to shine. In fact, I'm going to push back on the darkness as Bruce Coburn puts it, until it bleeds daylight. Yes, this chapter of American history may be filled with hate and anger, but I'm going to rise above these dark impulses. I have within myself the resources I need, not just to survive in these difficult times, but to thrive in them. That is ferocious optimism. That is biblical hope. Which brings us, finally, to love, the last and greatest of these three virtues, the one that stands above all others. To get to the nature of this love, we must first quickly dispel a misconception. Because 1 Corinthians is read so often at weddings, we've come to believe that the love it describes is has a kind of gauzy hallmark quality. That may be the love of our romantic dreams, but it's not the love Paul is talking about. We know this because he did not address his letter to a couple on the threshold of joining their lives together. He's writing instead to the Christians in Corinth, which is to say, he's addressing these words to a community in crisis. The church in Corinth is riven by any number of intense conflicts, social conflicts around race and gender, class conflicts around who's in and who's out, theological conflicts around who can sit at the Lord's table and partake of the Lord's supper and who gets to eat crumbs at the kiddies' table. Or to put all that more simply, the Corinthian church was divided over the question of whether the lives of rich, privileged men matter the most, or whether the lives of women and slaves and the other marginalized members of the community matter just as much. Utopia for realists. And if you don't believe me, read it for yourself. It's right there on the page. Paul speaks his truth about the nature of love into this context, into a messy, complex, contentious world, which is to say, a world just like ours. On Tuesday, I got a firsthand glimpse of what this messy, contentious world looks like. I went to a town hall meeting in Swannanoa, right here in Swannanoa, hosted by our local congressional representative. The tension and anger in the room were palpable and also completely predictable. Because anger is what you feel if you're poor and you or your children have a pre-existing condition and your health insurance is at risk of being taken away. It's what you feel if you're a patriotic American and your ability to serve your country in the armed forces is about to be denied because of your gender identity. It's what you feel if you're a person of color and you're made to feel unsafe in your own neighborhood or unwelcome in this country where you've lived and worked for 30 years and where you've raised your children and your grandchildren. Even if none of those things is true for me, I understand this anger. As people of faith, we are allies with those who are feeling it. We are in the fight for the soul and for the future of this country, and I'm all for taking this fight to town halls and to the streets. But I also believe there is a more excellent way than shouting at each other. And that as Christian people, how we engage this struggle matters a great deal. I believe that if white supremacists ever do march here, then yes, it is absolutely our job to go out and meet them and resist them. But I also believe the best way to do this is to patiently take our stand and sing. I believe that a warm loaf of freshly baked bread will always convey the truth of what we believe more clearly than a white hot dose of heated argument. I believe that in almost every circumstance, it's more important to be kind than it is to be right. Which is why, in the end, I believe that faith, hope, and love, these three abide, but that the greatest of these is love, and that the one that stands above them all, today and always. Amen.